From the Center for European Reform, this is the CER podcast.
Posons-nous sérieusement la question de l'avenir que nous voulons et ayons tous ensemble le courage de le construire.
Für uns in Deutschland ist das Bekenntnis zum vereinten Europa Teil unserer Staatsräson.
A strong united Europe is a necessity for the world because an integrated Europe remains vital to our international order.
This is the moment for Europe to lead the way towards a new vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Centre for European Reform podcast. I'm Zach Myers, Assistant Director at the CER. The EU has for many years been a huge proponent of better regulation, which are steps to make sure that EU regulations are evidence-based, made in a transparent and inclusive way, and that they're as simple and targeted as possible to reduce unnecessary burdens. And in many respects, the EU leads the world in better regulation practices. But recent years have seen some contradictions. The Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, started her term by making better regulation a priority. But then she was faced with a series of crises like COVID and the war in Ukraine, which required faster and less evidence-based decision-making. And more generally, there's been a perception that the quality of regulation in the EU might have decreased in recent years, and that some recent regulations, especially when it comes to the green agenda, are not always proportionate. European politicians are also really worried about the bloc's slow growth and its perceived lack of competitiveness. As we're approaching the next EU elections, many leaders are worried that EU regulations could be hindering productivity growth and innovation. For her part, von der Leyen's promised to cut red tape for businesses and has tasked the former Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi to report on how to improve European competitiveness. If she gets a second term, she's also promising to slow down lawmaking and reinvigorate better regulations. But there are still lots of questions about how to ensure that happens. To explain more about how Europe is thinking about better regulation, I'm delighted that we have with us Anthony Teasdale. Anthony is a visiting professor at the London School of Economics and an adjunct professor at Columbia University. Among many other distinguished roles in the UK and the EU, he was Director General of the European Parliamentary Research Service, which is the in-house think tank of the European Parliament, for nearly a decade. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you. And congratulations on what's an extremely interesting document, if I may say so, the paper you've produced on better regulation in Europe, an action plan for the next commission. It's really great to see people looking at these kind of policy cycles, better lawmaking and better regulation issues in detail. Not many people do that. And I think this is actually exactly the right time to do it, because we're coming to the end of 1 5-year cycle in the EU, namely the 2019-24 political cycle, first term. We don't know whether it'll be the only term of Ursula von der Leyen, and we're about to start later this year a new 5-year cycle through from 2014 to 2019. So this is, you know, really the right time to be looking at these issues, and hats off to CER for trying to stimulate that debate both in London and indeed in Brussels.
Thanks, Anthony. The EU compares, as I said, very well to other countries in terms of consulting widely, assessing the impacts of the proposals, reviewing legislation to check that it's fit for purpose. It's generally come at the top of the OECD rankings in terms of better regulation practices. But increasingly, there's perceptions that there is a mismatch between the letter of better regulation and the spirit, with the Commission being perceived sometimes to have decided quite early on in the policymaking process what approach it wants to take, and concern then from businesses and other stakeholders that consultations and impact assessments are often being used to kind of rubber stamp decisions that have already been made. And I just kind of wondered the extent to which you agreed with that as a diagnosis.
I kind of agree with you and I don't agree with you at the same time, because I think the credit needs to be given to the EU institutions, particularly the Commission, in that it adopts a kind of policy cycle approach. It looks at the inception of law, the way law is being adopted, and it plays a central role in that, of course, despite the fact that it's not either branch of the legislature, because it's the Commission's proposal, which is the one that others work on. And when they amend it, they need to get the Commission to agree to that amendment. Otherwise, absolute majority provisions apply in terms of lawmaking. And then they have a special responsibility for the implementation and enforcement of it and making sure that it works well on the ground. And I think the Commission tries to adopt this approach more and more. It's not just a sausage factory for new legislative proposals. It's something where the Commission itself has to take responsibility for what eventually ends up on the statute book. And law is absolutely central to the way that the Commission thinks, because it's the power that it has. The unique feature of the European Union is the existence of supranational law, and the unique feature of the EU political system in terms of the position of the Commission is it gets, and only it gets, to make the legislative proposals. So it's quite natural that the Commission has been thinking more and more in recent years in this policy cycle way. And that's good. I think that itself encourages a more serious conversation about the content of law and the way that it is implemented and applied, and whether you need new law. And so impact assessment and ex post evaluation, they go together, and ideally they should join up. That is, you know, you review existing law and policy and how it's working in practice, and that then guides you in terms of what you propose in terms of improvements. And given that the EU now covers so many different areas of policy, so many, the virgin territory, if you like, has already been filled in. And now you can see that process. And if you want to look at that, you can see in the legislation that's being passed right now in the EU institutions, a huge amount of it is to do with updating existing law rather than completely new law. The real problem, in my view, is in relation to completely new areas of policy, or areas where the policy imprint, if you like, of the Commission and the other EU institutions has up till now been very light. And a lot of this has followed from the successive crises that we've been through in the last couple of decades. I mean, starting really with the whole justice and home affairs explosion, if you like, after 9/11, right the way through now to the emergency legislation that we've seen in respect of coronavirus, in respect of the Ukraine war, and the energy dimension specifically of the Ukraine war with migration and other things in between. Where you have a big expansion of EU competence, either de facto or de jure, you inevitably get new legislation or new policy initiatives in areas which haven't previously been filled. If you like, the sort of acquis grows in areas which were previously empty. And that is the moment of weakness for the EU system, because by definition, you haven't got ex post evaluations to look to. And almost by definition, it's very difficult to be sure what the implications of new law will be. Doing an ex ante impact assessment is a pretty haphazard process. And very often, because of the time pressures, it gets left out or left behind. I think the other feature which I would point to, which is kind of more systemic, is that the EU's lawmaking system is actually a very fast and a very efficient lawmaking system. I was quite struck, actually, on looking at some figures recently, that the average time from the proposal by the European Commission to the agreement, usually at first reading, between the institutions has fallen in recent years from 18 months to 13 months. Now, where it goes to second reading, which is quite rare, it's still about 38 months. And if we were to go back 20 years ago, we would have found it was much more on average, more like 38 months than 13 months. This is a very fast system. And of course, as a result of the fastness of the system, it's quite difficult in practice to stop the clock, look in more detail at particular new ideas that might be floated, amendments that might be put forward either in the Parliament or in the Council. And that is, I think, being compounded by pressures from the presidency, the successive presidencies of the Council, to try to get as much legislation passed as possible during their six-month term. And ironically, the invention of the President of the European Council, by taking away the prestige of holding the rotating presidency, has placed much greater emphasis on this lawmaking output aspect of the presidency. So it's a fast system, it's an efficient system, but it can also, as a result, be a system which perhaps is not taking account of as many of the implications as it should of law that's being adopted quickly. If I may, I just add a further point, which is that we've got a very high degree of turnover in the European Parliament. We saw 60% at the last Euro elections turnover of members. People who have been looking at the lists and so on are expecting it's going to be at least 50% again at the European elections in a few weeks' time. And now that there are so many member states of the European Union, the presidency is only held once every 14 years or so by any individual country. So the institutional memory, if you like, of the members of the institutions is declining. And therefore, it's not as easy as it used to be, either in the Parliament or in the Council, to take account of previous experience. And it's more likely that members, if they're going to be there, either for a shorter period of time, or they're only going to have a relatively short period of time in the sun, as it were, are likely to want to ensure maximum output. Now, compare that with the United States, where you've got a situation of complete gridlock, in effect, between two houses and between the executive and the legislative branch, and you have to ask yourself, if there are weaknesses in lawmaking, which would you prefer to have? Would you prefer to have a US system which is very, very sluggish and where it's incredibly difficult to actually get anything through, or an EU system which seems astonishingly efficient and speedy in doing so? I would take slight issue with the debate about, or with you on this question, which is a real debate, I know, about whether there's been a decline in the quality or an increase in the burden that's discernible in terms of impacts on business. I don't know enough about the business community to be sure, but at every stage in the history of the European Union, business has usually been claiming that burdens are excessive and probably that they've been growing. Maybe only at the time of the height of the single market programme would it have been different to that. I would just add the comment that if Anu Bradford is right in her thesis with the Brussels effect, that in a market-driven way, more perhaps than any other way, you're seeing the export of EU regulatory standards worldwide, it is surprising that you would come to the view that they were that bad. I mean, also, given that they have to be agreed by 27 member states, as well as the possibility of rejection in the European Parliament, you're likely, if anything, to get the lowest common denominator outcome in terms of the legislative process, what sort of passepartout legislation. And maybe that's one of the reasons why so many of the proposals which are put forward stick. The Commission has got much, much better in trying to work out in advance whether or not it's going to be able to meet the centre of gravity, both in the Council and in the Parliament, and put forward things which it broadly thinks are going to get through. And evidently, that judgment is right. Sometimes it gets it wrong. There was a recent example, as you probably followed, of the so-called Platform Work Directive, which had an enormously tortuous and a difficult and painful birth. And in a situation where two of the most important member states in the EU didn't vote for the final conclusion, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, Germany abstained and France voted against. But that type of outcome is relatively rare. And normally, the European Commission is pretty shrewd in the way that it approaches the use of its legislative initiative. So that's been a rather long-winded comment on what you said. But you're making a lot of different propositions in one sentence, as it were. And I thought it's quite good to just take apart some of these pieces, because the EU system does take a lot of flack, is regarded as pretty complicated, but in fact is actually surprisingly efficient.
No, and in fact, on that point, I would absolutely agree. It really resonated when you said that the problems, the more controversial aspects, are when the Commission is legislating in new areas where there isn't currently any key of existing laws. And, you know, that's absolutely the case in the digital sector, where I think a lot of these concerns about the speed of regulation are, well, in at least my view, and this is the area that I know best, you know, they have some justification, I think, because there's been about 116 laws passed that touch the digital sector in one way or the other in the last 5 years. And it seems to me that it's very difficult for the Commission to undertake a proper evaluation of how the existing legal regime looks and whether new laws are required when the existing laws haven't really been embedded or properly implemented yet. But I think, you know, you're absolutely right that you've really got to look at it sector by sector, and the kind of evaluation that the EU does of existing areas are definitely more effective in minimising regulatory burdens where, you know, the laws have already been in place for a long time. The other aspect of this, which I think is often mentioned, is that personalities matter a lot too. And von der Leyen has often been described as kind of a very kind of top-down leader who is very decisive and assertive. And I think that has had huge benefits for the EU in recent years when it comes to tackling the types of crises that you mentioned, like coronavirus, like the war in Ukraine. But I think there's also a sense that perhaps that can lead to a willingness to maybe cut corners, and a sense that consultations and impact assessments are not quite as open-minded as they should be. And also that decision-making, even within the EU institutions, is not as inclusive as it could be. So, for example, you know, von der Leyen is well known to be engaging directly with directors general and sometimes bypassing the commissioners in the process. Do you think that sort of personality factor is important too? And I'm thinking also of just the way that EU laws are implemented and enforced. So, for example, you have a commission that sometimes does need to play the bad cop and to bring cases against member states for not implementing the EU law properly at a member state level. And the Commission has been much more willing to do that in the past and less willing to do that in the last few years. And also when it comes to enforcing these laws against the private sector. So I think that when it comes to something like competition policy, there's been a real concern that it would be used in politicized ways. I think actually DG Comp has been quite rigorous and very independent in the way it's enforced EU competition law, clearly willing to stand up to big, powerful member states like France and Germany and stand up for principles. But I wonder the extent to which you think that's been reliant on having the right people at the top, or whether there are enough kind of institutional protections
Well, of course, it's a very long way from the president of the European Commission's office at the top of the Berlin Wall, right the way through to the implementation and enforcement of every piece of EU legislation. I mean, on the question of implementation, etc., I would say that, first of all, the member states have a very strong vested interest in the legislation which they agree to at EU level being enforceable and viable. And so too, actually, does the European Commission, because the Commission doesn't want to get enmeshed in thousands of legal cases any more than that the individual member states want to be confronted with them. So it's very important that in the council working groups, in an earlier stage in my career, I did work in the council secretariat, actually. It's very important that in those working groups, the member states field people who can speak with authority about the way that the legislation in question is going to actually apply in that member state, and that those concerns can be expressed early on and can be taken into account. I don't think the Commission generally wants to steamroller things through against the viability at member state level, which is different to the question of whether member states might be ideologically or for some other reason opposed or resistant to legislation. And there has been some academic literature recently on this kind of resistance through the back door, with member states trying to effectively undermine or even sabotage in some cases implementation and enforcement, etc. So I think that's important to take that into account. And obviously, as the EU becomes more practiced in particular policy fields, so it's less likely that the Commission in any case will put forward legislation that's likely to run into those difficulties. It's more likely in the new fields. We saw a bit of this actually, you know, 10 or more years ago after the economic financial crisis, with the tightening up of the regulation of the financial services sector and the new regulatory bodies that were created, and of course the whole new body of legislation that was adopted, very often for the first time. And so that would be an example of learning by doing. Where the Commission has been in the game for decades, it makes fewer mistakes inevitably. It's a kind of general comment I would make on that. On the question of kind of political leadership, well, I think leadership is enormously important. And I mean, had Ursula von der Leyen not been a kind of upfront figure who was prepared to, first of all, put forward a kind of attractive and coherent agenda 5 years ago, and secondly, if she had proved to be somebody who couldn't step up to the plate when the successive crisis risked completely knocking off course the progress of the Commission, we would be now turning around and lamenting the absence of leadership rather than criticising what might be some of its excesses. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. This in political life, as in life generally, you rarely get the best of all worlds. And in this case, I would have thought that without, you know, making any comment about her prospects for renomination, re-election, etc., I mean, I think there is a general consensus that Ursula von der Leyen has been one of the more impressive commissioners in the history of that institution. So not everybody would have expected that when she emerged rather unexpectedly 5 years ago. In the same way as if you go back to 1985, expectations were pretty low for Jacques Delors when he assumed responsibility for the commission. This leads on to another issue, which indeed you kind of address obliquely in the paper that you've written for the CER, which is the question of what you might call the politicisation of the European Commission. I mean, I sometimes think that there's a bit of a misunderstanding about this on a couple of different levels. The first is, I don't think you can ever have an apolitical European Commission. I mean, the Commission is an executive, it has certain powers, and it will exercise them. And any way that it exercises it is political. The only question is how party political it is, or how controversial it is. So politics is inherent. But I think that more specifically, we've had two successive commissioners, Jean-Claude Juncker and now Ursula von der Leyen, who have used the word political in the way that they've described their essential kind of mission or message. Juncker talked about it being a political commission. Von der Leyen talked about it being a geopolitical commission. Now, obviously, politics and geopolitics aren't exactly the same thing. But to most of us, we firmly understand that means you've got a sense of direction and you feel you have a mandate and you've got to step up to and deal with the big issues. Again, I think they would have been criticised if they hadn't been prepared to step up to the big issues. And there's much more continuity than people generally recognise between the two commissions, because it was under Juncker that both the digital issue and what we now call the Green Deal, the whole climate change agenda, featured absolutely centrally if you compare it with his predecessor. So they are inherently political in terms of just exercising power, and they chose to be more explicitly political. I think the party politicisation issue has been exaggerated. I mean, whatever one thinks of the Spitzenkandidat process, and generally I'm in favour of it, but whatever you think about it, the reality is that it's only the top three or four jobs in the European Commission that have been assigned as a result of party labels. And we saw, of course, even though people say that the Spitzenkandidat process kind of failed in inverted commas in 2019, we saw in Timmermans and Investiger, two people who had been either in the first case an actual Spitzenkandidat or in the second case de facto Spitzenkandidat for their political family, get two of the absolutely top jobs in the commission. And I would say that having a situation where the leadership of the commission has an EPP person, a socialist person, a liberal person, far from representing a kind of betrayal, if you like, of the neutral technocratic or technical competence and embodiment of the European interest, which is the sort of stereotypical and rather anachronistic view, I think, of how the Commission ever really was. I think actually you could argue it provides, having those people at the top, provides a kind of political stability and balance to the system, which actually strengthens it. So I'm not so worried about there being a kind of new political approach. And indeed, the whole better lawmaking agenda and better regulation agenda, which has become embedded in the heart of Commission policymaking, in any case, acts as a safeguard against what you might describe as excessively ideological or idiosyncratic proposals somehow getting through. And the era that, you know, some of us can even remember back in, you know, the so-called good old days, where a commissioner or his or her chef de cabinet would go into the office one morning and just decide that they thought they needed to have a legislative initiative in an area. And then, you know, under a sort of dog doesn't eat dog policy, none of the other commissioners would express any view on this, and it would just go through and then perhaps blow up either in the council or in the parliament. That's much, much rarer. There are multiple safeguards now. On the question of consultation, it's very difficult to be against consultation. Obviously, it's a good thing. The Commission has tended to open its consultations for, I don't know, 8 to 12 weeks generally. And if you look on their website, one of the most disappointing features actually is how few responses they get, mainly from affected vested interests, naturally enough. But actually getting through to the general public and trying to sense whether or not the man or woman in the street thinks this is a good idea and whether there are any sort of common sense propositions they would like to inject in the debate, it's virtually impossible. Now, they have tried. They've got a new portal, and how far they take genuine account of that, I'm not in a position to judge. But I think they've certainly been making some efforts. And if one can think through more ways of consulting the public, those that are going to be most directly affected, of course, it's be a good thing. But the European Parliament is, after all, supposed to be the embodiment of the elected representatives of the people. And you've also got the advisory bodies in the form of the Economic and Social Committee and the Committee of the Regions. So you've got other inputs which should take account of popular feeling and the attitudes of citizenry towards it. So I'm a bit fatalistic on this question of how far you can actually really meaningfully strengthen the consultation process. If I was asked what is the weakness of the EU lawmaking system at the moment, I would say it was less about advanced consultation than it was the speed and the pressures which are on the legislators to get the outcome through quickly. And if that could be a little bit slowed down or disentangled, there might be benefits in terms of quality of law that results. Now, in your paper, and I want to ask you a bit about this, if I may, just for a moment, I'll ask you a question. In there, you proposed that the European Parliament, the Council of Ministers, should take more seriously the commitment which they entered into in the Interinstitutional Agreement on Better Lawmaking, edition 2016, I think, was the one where they inserted these words, where they said that they will, when they consider it appropriate and necessary, undertake impact assessments on their amendments, substantive amendments to proposals. As somebody who, when I was heading up as Director General, the EPRS had a specific unit as part of a broader directorate on ex ante impact assessment, I'm very conscious of how difficult it is to get legislators, and I know it's exactly the same problem in the Council, it's not just a Parliament problem, to stop the clock and say, yes, actually, do you know what? Having some further analytical work on this would be really valuable. It would test whether or not it's going to work, and it would also doubtless bring to bear you know, other insights which we don't currently have, which would help us improve the quality of the legislation. But our experience was that it would require about 3 months, I mean, to do it properly, probably 4 or 5, in fact, to do a really serious piece of impact assessment analysis on a major amendment. And the biggest single problem we confronted was not so much, as some people argue, a complete lack of political will to do impact assessment. It was a worry that it just was not something that they could do in practice in the time required. And if we had our own internal facility that could do it so that it was specialist enough in all the different policy areas to do this, we would have had to have an absolutely enormous staff working on impact assessment rather than the sort of between about 7 and 12 people we had at any given time. And so that's the reason why I'm sure, incidentally, that there are similar problems over in the Council. whatever the question of political will. And that's one of the reasons why we have focused over there, or at least we did when I was running the show, we focused over there on analysing the quality, the strengths, the weaknesses, and so on, of Commission impact assessments, so that our members could be as best informed as possible about this when they were looking at the proposal that had been put on the table. And you say, I think, in your pamphlet that, well, do you know what, perhaps that's a bit of a replication of the work being done by the Regulatory Scrutiny Board in the Commission. It might be in certain areas, but actually we don't get to see that work until much later. And what we were trying to do was do it from a kind of Parliament perspective, what we know our members are interested in. And we've highlighted a number of weaknesses, even though it's great that the Commission is producing so many impact assessments, and, you know, one pays tribute to them for doing that much more systematically than any other jurisdiction, I think, in the world, certainly more than in the United States or even in the United Kingdom, where in the United States it tends to be on implementing measures, and in the UK it's very much on burdens for business rather than the wider economic, social, environmental, third country, whatever it might be, impacts. But I mean, there is an issue here, but I actually have great difficulty seeing how one can solve it easily and quickly. And I wondered what your own perspective was on how you might kickstart that system, either in the Council or in the Parliament.
Thanks, Anthony. Indeed, I think it's a really, really difficult question. And I don't want to suggest that it's only a question of political will. I think there are really practical questions around how you would implement impact assessments on MEP amendments or member state proposed amendments. I mean, one of the dilemmas is you want it done as early in the process as possible so that MEPs and member states have an opportunity to think about and consider the impact assessments that are then done. But the earlier it is in the process, the more speculative it is as to whether a particular substantial amendment is going to get approved or not within that institution. And so you might end up with a lot of work that is wasted. I think it might make sense to do it at least initially by doing impact assessments on the finished draft law, which is passed by the Parliament, so that then in trialogue, the Commission, the MEP representatives and the member state representatives can all kind of consider what the proposed changes are and compare those against the Commission impact assessment. Obviously, I think there are problems with the trialogue process in terms of transparency, in terms of making sure that impacts are systematically considered at that point. And, you know, many people have written on this in the past. I'm very interested in your views. I found it kind of too tricky to come to any particular recommendation in my paper on how the trialogue process could be improved beyond mere improving transparency. But it seems to me that starting these impact assessments towards the end, when we kind of know what the three institutions' positions are going to be, would probably be the best way to do that. And that would mean kind of lengthening the final stage of the process, but of lawmaking. But that does seem to be the area where, you know, if you speak to most people, if you speak to the business community, that's where they're most worried that actually you get something that doesn't look like any of the initial legislative proposals from any of the institutions. I mean, examples of that are, you know, the Artificial Intelligence Act, where you had like an entirely new regime for very large language learning models. There was not something that had been kind of considered at all 6 months before. And so it's very hard to see that as a good example of lawmaking.
Yeah, you point to a very powerful example of that. It's very interesting. You mentioned this idea of doing a kind of impact assessment on the emerging consensus, if you like, because obviously the different institutions go into the trialogue process with different perspectives, and then they usually can be a bloody or not so bloody process, but they usually come up with something which they can all agree, and then everybody gets behind it. And actually, ironically, it becomes rather difficult to pinpoint who exactly the winner and the loser was between the various institutions. And that's been a source of some criticism in the European Parliament, where people have said, well, hang on a minute, what did we actually achieve? And so it's quite useful now that there's a kind of mandate given to the negotiators before, which has to be approved in plenary, which essentially one can look back to and compare and contrast. But even so, it's often quite fuzzy. I see that EPRS, the Parliamentary Research Service, recently produced actually quite an interesting document in which they attempt to identify what the achievements, in inverted commas, of the European Parliament have been, mainly in the legislative process over this five-year term. Now, towards the very end of his tenure in the last European Commission, because he's also been in this one, Frans Timmermans, who was then inter alia responsible for better lawmaking and better regulation, he did actually put forward a suggestion. He publicly voiced the view that there should be this kind of end of process impact assessment done on the text that's emerged through co-decision. And he got pretty short shrift, both from the Parliament and the Council, and for all I know among his other Commission colleagues, but I can't verify that, when he said this, because the view tends to be, that was a pretty bloody experience. We got through it. Do we really want to reopen it now? And is there the risk that if a particular part of the package turns out to be problematic, that then the totality falls apart? And anyway, let's just get on and do it. There's also been this parallel suggestion that there could be a kind of independent body of some kind of impact assessment agency, if you like, that would take all of these proposals at whatever stage and run them through with a view to trying to identify what could be problematic. And of course, especially the changes to the legislative proposal that might be being put forward in the Parliament or the Council. That too has not so far found favour with the other institutions. Now, that's not to say that there couldn't be some advantages to going down either of these routes, but many of the same political problems, and these aren't just party or ideological problems that do inherit in a way with the political process, because people become locked into and have a vested interest in the outcome, kick in and make it quite difficult to envisage reforms in this direction. But it's certainly an area that needs to be looked at. And I think one of the benefits of your paper on better regulation in Europe is that you've opened up a kind of discussion about how to do this within the institutions and potentially collectively between them. My personal view is that the benefit of impact assessment lies in changing the mentality and the thinking inside the European Commission. I mean, you've now got virtually everybody who's involved in the lawmaking, the generation of law in the Commission, thinking not only about impact assessment in kind of general terms and mainstreaming that in their activity, because otherwise they can't get their proposals through the Commission itself, but also looking specifically at all these multiple angles, the economic, the social, the environmental, the crossover with other EU priorities, the impacts on SMEs, territorial impacts, impacts on third countries, gender impacts, human rights impact, administrative burdens, you name it, in a way that 20 years ago or so, nobody was thinking in that way. And cumulatively, over time, this has a very big impact in making the policymaking process more sophisticated. Now, you can say, well, that's great, but isn't there a sort of tendency towards box ticking here? And that there's also a natural process, particularly in the EU institutions with so many different nationalities and cultures, to reduce everything to process and to not worry so much about substance. And I would readily accept that there are dangers in that regard. But ultimately, at the heart of the impact assessment, there has to be two or three things. One is the problem definition. What is it that's wrong here and either needs to be addressed and corrected or could be improved upon? So what is the added value of European level action? The second is, what are the potential options that are available to the European Union in addressing this issue? And you make some very good points in your paper about the way in which these options need to be real options and not just, you know, a kind of central proposal of the Commission and then a couple of outliers. And this point has been made quite forcibly, not only by the EP in the work that EPRS has done, but also by the Regulatory Scrutiny Board, and the Commission has got much, much better on that. And then third, to actually try to work through what the strengths and weaknesses of these different options are. And if these core components of an impact assessment are missing, they get picked up on. And, you know, it's not for nothing that in the Regulatory Scrutiny Board, if I'm not mistaken, the last year for which I've got figures anyway, 2022, there were only 25% of unambiguously positive first opinions given by the Regulatory Scrutiny Board. And there were, I think from memory, about 35% of negative first opinions. And of course, you're in between the two as well. That's a kind of wake-up call for people who are in the services in the Commission, which is, I really don't want to have our work being criticised in this way. There's a 1 in 3 chance, at least, that that's the case just statistically. That's more than negligible. It focuses people's minds. And I think that the real benefit of the impact assessment process is not actually about the amendments. It's more to do with the solidity and viability of the original legislative proposal. And I would make two other points on this, if I may. One is that actually, under the trilogue process, which is the normal process now, first reading agreements coming out, the Commission has to give its approval to these amendments. I mean, in the sense, it's not obliged to give it, but they cannot go through without the Commission agreeing. Otherwise, a more laborious process kicks in, including the possibility that QMV would be placed by unanimity in the Council. So the Commission is in a very strong position at that point to say, we have some problems with this. The second point, which is linked to it, is that the IEIA, provides for, and indeed the right of initiative, which the Commission enjoy, automatically provides for, the fact that the European Commission itself can do additional impact assessment work on at any stage in the legislative process. It, if it wanted, could do an impact assessment on every single council or parliament amendment, if it wanted to. So you have to ask also the question of whether or not there's a certain self-denying ordinance being applied in the European Commission in the way that they treat the twin arms of the legislature. I just raise that point because if there were to be a feeling that the Parliament or the Council is falling down in that regard, the Commission has the capacity, if it chooses, including the many thousands of civil servants, including the people who drafted the legislative proposals, on hand to maybe take a further look.
Indeed. And I think that, you know, one practical way in which impact assessments can be done further down the line with substantial amendments is by asking the Commission staff to do it, because, of course, you know, they are far better resourced than the Parliament or the Council. One of the points that really resonated with me that you just said was on this connection between the politics of lawmaking and the kind of procedural aspects of better regulation. And it's been quite impressive, I think, to see that even though in theory the Commission can overrule the Regulatory Scrutiny Board as often as it likes, that's happened extremely rarely in practice. I think the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive was the only time I can think of in recent years that the Commission has said, well, yes, we understand that the Regulatory Scrutiny Board doesn't approve of this impact assessment and doesn't think it's good enough, but we think there's a political imperative to move forward anyway. So I think that there is this interplay between procedure and politics, which means that you can't just say that politics necessarily trumps procedure in every way. And I think, you know, that speaks more broadly to what we're trying to achieve with the Better Regulation Agenda, which is to put in place a choice framework to make sure that we're not just listening to big businesses that have the biggest lobbying budgets, but there's a kind of a systemic way to think about all of the different impacts on different groups, including, and this is kind of important for me, thinking about economic growth, not just kind of today's incumbent businesses, but what are the impacts on innovation? What are the impacts on small, medium enterprises who we want to be able to kind of disrupt the economy and cause problems for big businesses that might not be as productive? So I think that really what we should be hoping to achieve with better regulation is this type of a choice framework rather than something that we kind of guarantee means that politics is put aside. We'll probably need to wrap up now, but I guess I just wanted to maybe ask a final question around the burden reduction agenda, because this is often one of the most controversial parts of better regulation. I think a lot of the process we can think of as making sure that lawmakers are informed and that they've got all the evidence available to them. But a lot of critics of burden reduction say, well, this goes a bit further by kind of forcing lawmakers to pull back on regulations that might have good public policy objectives purely because of kind of the cost that they cause. And when I look at the way that one in, one out, which is this concept that von der Leyen has introduced, saying that every time you introduce a regulatory burden, you should remove an equivalent one, she seems to have adopted it in a way that I think is quite flexible. It's the first year, so I think it needs more development and more transparency. But I think it has served well to make sure that lawmakers are conscious of the costs that regulation imposes and that we don't just take them for granted and think that we can keep piling them up without looking at what's already there. I thought, just as a final question, I'd get your views on how this one in, one out process has been working so far from your perspective.
Well, I have to say, I'm not an expert precisely in this, but what I would say is two things. The first is that, of course, it was controversial from the start. I mean, it was a bit sort of slightly zany, let's put it that way, that when von der Leyen announced fairly suddenly that she planned to apply this principle in 2019. Only 2 years before, in 2017, Juncker, as I understand it, he and the Commission had said that they thought that it was pretty undesirable because it would bias the system in favour of deregulatory pressures and impair what I think they called the Commission's political responsibility to deliver what needs to be done when it needs to be done. That's kind of one observation. The second would be the current European Commission under von der Leyen committed to introduce, either at the beginning or at some other points during its five-year term, over 600 major initiatives. Now, you know, you'd have to have an awful lot of corresponding deregulation to completely offset what must be inherently, in some features of those 600 proposals, some regulatory dimensions which can be interpreted as burdens or obligations on business or on economic actors, let's put it that way. So I wonder whether they haven't set themselves what you might call a contested objective, which is too ambitious, at least to start with. I mean, as a way of thinking, it's not a bad way of thinking, which is that if the effect of legislation is to add burdens, that you might also want to be looking at how you can reduce burdens. But, you know, even that, which might sound like a sort of, you know, sensible general principle, is laden with all sorts of political implications, as we know. So whilst I'm sure they're trying hard in this respect, and I'm sure they want to strike the right balance, and they don't want it to be a kind of automatic or mechanical process, I've never myself been convinced that the one in, one out principle is a kind of useful central point, if you like, in a kind of better lawmaking agenda. Let me put it that way. I wouldn't really have invested as much political capital in it as I think the current European Commission has done so. So we wait and see. It's only been applied, I think, for 18 months to 2 years. So it's very, very early days yet. I'm sure when the original concept of impact assessment was launched 20 odd years ago, there would have been people saying exactly the same about that. And now, 20 years on, most people say actually it's a very valuable approach to thinking through new policies and legislative initiatives. So let's hope it can be finessed in a way that makes it effective and malleable. But for me, it's not absolutely central to the success or failure of the better lawmaking or indeed the better regulation agenda. What I think is central to it is to have enough time and space in the legislative process to think things through in a more or a less pressured and a slightly more relaxed way than the kind of freneticism which has recently become the norm in the EU lawmaking process. And this freneticism, incidentally, is inadvertently promoted by the five-year cycle, because you have towards the end, like right now, enormous, particularly in the last 6 months, enormous pressures on both the Council and the Parliament to get through the outstanding agenda items. And it's really been very intense. And then you have, characteristically, at the beginning of the five-year term, the empty legislative agenda as the Commission seeks to try to convert its mandate and all those proposals which people have been putting forward and suggesting into some kind of legislative form. And that's the moment, of course, when it's easiest to do, and there's enough bandwidth to undertake ex post evaluation. So I really hope that when, you know, the new Parliament and the new Commission come into office later this year, as well as under the successive Council presidencies, maybe in the second half of this year and the beginning of next year, that there will be more emphasis than there has been in the past on ex post evaluation, on review, on taking stock of what has been working and how legislation could be improved for the future. Because you get between a 6 and 18 month sort of window there before those pressures absolutely come in and are so impactful as the five-year legislative term proceeds. So try to take advantage of that opportunity that's coming up later this year. And your paper on better regulation in Europe, it would be a very good primer for anybody who wants to think about doing that.
That's very kind of you to say. Thanks, Anthony. And I certainly agree that, you know, we're in a kind of a strange time with the wrapping up of files. It's interesting how much additional power the Commission's getting through delegated and implementing acts to kind of really influence not only how laws are implemented in a narrow way, but also kind of the scope of the laws and, you know, a lot of substantive requirements that you would really think would be matters for the co-legislators to agree on. On the next 18-month period after the elections, I'm kind of hopeful that we'll see more of an emphasis on ex post evaluations. They're becoming more and more important and taking kind of a more systemic role in the lawmaking cycle in Brussels, which I think is one positive development. But look, there are so many elements of the better regulation agenda. I feel like we could be sitting here and talking for the whole day, and I'm sorry that we can't, but we really appreciate your time, Anthony. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a great pleasure, and thank you to everybody, yourself and others at the CER, for putting these issues firmly on the agenda.
Thank you, Anthony. This has been another episode of the Centre for European Reforms podcast. You can find us on SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the CER podcast. If you have any feedback for us or want to leave suggestions for a future episode, then you can find us on Twitter @CER_EU.